Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Dawn? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7pm here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
Hit the music. It's Saturday, it's just after 11, and you know what that means? It's time for the Live Science Radio Show.
Wow, what a totally amazing, excellent discovery.
It will test your head, and your mind, and your brain, too.
Come on, let's go, space trucker!
Yes, good morning. Welcome to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire. Or sheffieldlive.org, you can listen online there. You can also go there for the podcast later, listen at your leisure and share them even. You've got Julie and Paul here live in the studio, as we always are, Saturday mornings, 11 till 12, talking about science in all its different forms. Later on in the show, we've got RPG on the line. I think he's talking about batteries. Oh, interesting. And we've also got a guest speaker this week. And generally every fourth Saturday of the month, it's Chris Dale. He's going to be talking about, let me get this right, UK food health and excess weight clinics, continuing that theme of food and obesity. Very interesting stuff. Every fourth Saturday moving forward, I think we're going to have George Dale on the line as well. Let's see. Next week as well, all being well, and every first Saturday of the month, it's Phil Muffett from the Mexburg and Swinton Astronomical Society. However, it's coming up to a very big and special birthday, so I think he's on his travels at the minute, so let's see. Before I forget, Paul's going to remind you of
the Festival of Debate, Tuesday 16th of April to Saturday 25th of May 2024. This year's South Yorkshire Festival, mainly based in Sheffield, has been programmed to explore three core questions, including how can we respond to the climate crisis and biosphere collapse. So that's www.festivalofdebate.com.
All interesting stuff. I'm now going to talk about a bit about health prescription changes over the years. I read this in a magazine quite a few, probably months ago actually, and I thought it was really interesting. So if you'd have been given a prescription 30 years ago, chances are it would have been for antibiotics, painkillers or an inhaler. But over the last 10 years, the most commonly prescribed medicines have been those used to treat high cholesterol, blood pressure and indigestion or stomach ulcers. Patients often depend on medicine to maintain health, prevent illness, manage chronic conditions and treat disease. And prescribing medication is the most common intervention provided to patients by the National Health Service or NHS and the second highest area of spending after staffing costs. So there's been some big changes to annual spend and volume of prescriptions over the years. In 2022-23, the cost of prescription items was a whopping £10.43 billion. Back in 2002, which is said 20 years ago, it was only £6.8 billion. So it's gone up quite a lot, but it's still a mighty big figure. Now, in terms of volume, the number of items dispensed by community pharmacies in 2023 was 1.18 billion. Interesting. 20 years ago, it was 650 million. So maybe half as much. So the national average, this is really interesting, the national average of items per head of the population is 21. At the turn of the century, so when we went into the 2000s, it was 11. So here in South Yorkshire, on average, the average number of items per head of the population is 25. And West Yorkshire has the highest average with 29 items per person. So the national average is 21. Here in South Yorkshire, it's 25. And in West Yorkshire, it's got the highest in the country with 29 items per person. Now, around 90% of prescriptions are dispensed free of charge, mainly to patients over the age of 60 who are exempt from prescription charges. Now, the amount of medication being prescribed has more than doubled over the last two decades. Now, that could be down to either an increased number of medicines available or just increased usage of previously perhaps unavailable medicines. Really interesting one as well. Top three medical areas that require medication. So in 2023, the cardiovascular system accounted for the highest proportion of medicines dispensed, with 344 million items, or equivalent to 29% of all items prescribed. Now, four of the top 10 items were those needed to treat heart disease or high cholesterol, such as statins and other lipid regulators. There's also been a rise in prevalence of cardiovascular disease in recent years, doubling from 271 million cases in 1990 to 523 million in 2019. In England, there are about 11.8 million adults with hypertension, which means high blood pressure. So when they're introduced in the 1990s, statins were only given to patients with very high cholesterol, whereas now they're usually started in patients with much lower cholesterol levels and have become the standard treatment for anyone who has had a heart attack. So the second highest area of where medical areas that require medication, the second highest is the nervous system, with 227 million items in that year, 2022-23. And that's 19% of all items prescribed. So the medicines for the nervous system are for pain, seizures, dementia, depression and other mental health conditions. Of course, dementia is the most common form of Alzheimer's. I think that's the right way around. It's one of the two ways around. The third highest area for prescriptions was the endocrine system, with 127 million items, which is 11% of all medicines prescribed. And they're types of medicines for diabetes, menopause, osteoporosis and thyroid problems. Interestingly, Chris Dale, when he comes on and talks to us later on, he'll be touching on diabetes as well. Now, the top three chemical substances prescribed number in 2022-23, number one, atorvastatin, number two, omeprazole, and number three, amlodipine. And I think Paul sat next to me is on two of them. I don't think he's on the middle one. But all those top three drugs have seen a huge increase in usage in recent years. Back in 2000, atorvastatin was the 45th most prescribed medicine, and it's now number one. So that's a big change in 20 years. And amlodipine used to be 16th most prescribed back, 20-odd years ago. It's now number three in the list. And at the other end of the top 10, the chemical substances are cholecalciferol, or vitamin D3, with 25.9 million items, metformin for type 2 of diabetes, and the antidepressant sertraline. Interesting. Now, another interesting point, antibiotics like amoxicillin used to be at the top of the table of substances prescribed, but the government brought in a five-year strategy in 2013 to slow the development and spread of antimicrobial resistance. All very interesting. Think about that when you collect your next prescription.
Ring with a friend, I said you called up a robber. Day or night, he'll be there any time at all, Dr. Robert. Dr. Robert, you're a new and better man. He helps you to understand. He does everything he can, Dr. Robert. If you're down, he'll pick you up, Dr. Robert. Dr. Robert, Dr. Robert.
That was Dr. Robert by the Beatles from their 1966 album Revolver, because we were talking about prescription changes over the years.
That's a long time ago. If you just tuned in, you're listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. Next up, this week's environment updates. I'm looking at Paul.
Ah, it's me first.
It is. Aha.
National Earth Day 2024 is an annual event on 22nd of April, that was last Monday, to demonstrate support for the environmental protection, which started in 1970. The official theme for 2024 is Planet versus Plastics, which aims to raise awareness of the harms of plastic pollution to humans and our planet. This year's focus comes ahead of the historic UN Treaty on Plastics, which is expected to be agreed by the end of 2024. More than 50 countries, including the UK, have called for an end to the plastic pollution by 2040. But the organisers of Earth Day want to go further and are calling for a 60% reduction in the production of all plastics by 2040. So you can go to www.earthday.org to find out.
Oh, very interesting. Now, the mayor's mission to rewild the Thames, Sadiq Khan, who's the mayor of London, wants to make the Thames clean enough to swim in within 10 years. The current quality of the water in the Thames, which last month made university rowers in the annual Oxford and Cambridge boat race become ill from E. coli, has been described as a national embarrassment.
Ooh. Yes, next, fight brewing over solar panel sunrush. Dozens of used solar farms are being planned in a sunrush driven by plummeting prices and the return of government subsidies. Even King Charles is getting in on the act. People who support solar farms say the facilities are vital for Britain's net zero drive, but others are furious about the impact on the countryside.
And some good news, bottom trawling ban. Greece has become the first EU country to ban bottom trawling in the country's marine protected areas. The practice, in which large nets are dragged along the seabed to catch fish, destroys habitats and releases carbon into the atmosphere. The Greek government also announced plans for two marine parks, putting the country on track to safeguard about a third of its waters.
And next, solar storage. A humanitarian charity has announced $10 million in grants for Native American communities to fund microgrid solar projects and energy storage. The action by Direct Relief comes after a report from the US Department of Energy called for greater energy resilience in indigenous communities, which are more likely to suffer higher levels of energy poverty.
And finally, some more good news. Wind win. Last year was the best year yet for wind energy projects, according to the latest Global Wind Report. The world installed 116 gigawatts of capacity, which is a 50% increase from 2022. The report's authors said that this shows the world is moving in the right direction in combating climate change, but warned that annual growth must increase to at least 320 gigawatts by 2030 to meet international climate pledges. it's a shame to turn it off. Song of the Wind by Santana from that album Caravanserai. Great stuff. And that was because we're talking about wind energy projects. We're on track. Things are improving. We're installing lots more gigawatts of wind power. Anyway, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live. We should have RPG on the line.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
Good morning. On a sunny, well, is it sunny morning?
It's a bit grey and overcast.
It is. It's not good this for April, is it?
It's pretty cool, isn't it?
It is. So what's caught your eye in the science press this week then, or the science news?
Well, a kind of a follow-on from last week, something with Sheffield University. And they've now been declared the UK Sustainable Aviation Fuels Clearinghouse.
Ooh!
So they worked on the test of the fuel that we talked about, where Virgin Atlantic did a trip from UK to America on this sort of sustainable fuel that has been developed. But because of the work they've done, now they're working in conjunction with a company called Ricardo UK to be a clearinghouse, which is a bit like the assay office, if you like, for aviation fuels of this type. So if somebody wants to introduce a new fuel to the market, then they're going to be able to test it and verify that it does what it should do.
Fantastic. That's quite an accolade, isn't it, for Sheffield then?
It's brilliant, and it's led by the Energy Institute of the University of Sheffield. So it's yet another thing where we're putting a little pin in the map to show where we are and what we're about.
I remember that the name Ricardo rings a bell with me because when I worked in air quality team in Sheffield, I'm sure some of our contracts were with Ricardo.
Yeah.
Environmental, consultancy, I think. Yeah, very interesting.
Yeah, in terms of futures, that's it's a great sort of signpost to where Sheffield's sort of talent's taking things. So.
Do you know who's involved in that then at Sheffield University?
No, I've got a rundown. I mean, we did it before, so unfortunately it didn't come to the tip of my tongue at the moment.
Particularly when you're not on live radio, Paul.
Yeah.
As people come to realise, doing it live is a bit of a different matter, isn't it?
Just, the spot's very sharp when you get on it. Oh, dear. Yeah, so the other thing that happened was my clock stopped.
Oh.
And I thought, what's that? Dig in the back, find the battery, take it out and put a new battery in. And I thought, crikey, you know, how much do we take for granted with batteries? So I thought I'd have a sort of dig round and see what I could find out about the sort of history and development of batteries.
Yeah, because they're everywhere, aren't they, now?
Well, that's the thing. I think a lot of people used to be surprised to find that in pretty much the bulk of computers when they started out, there was a battery buried in the middle of it. Yes. Even though it was a mains machine, and it was a battery backup for things like the date and some of the memory functions. So there used to be one of those flat button batteries in the middle of your computer, and if it went, then all of a sudden your computer lost track of time. So it's kind of stuff that, everywhere. And I thought, well, how long have they been around? And I think we've talked before about scientific instruments where they used to rub cats to get static electricity.
I'm sure you'd get locked up for doing things like that, Paul.
But the ancient Greeks even knew that if you got some amber and rubbed it, then it would attract particles of dust and things. So there was kind of the inklings of that. But then I think early on in last century, they found a place called Karjut, just outside Baghdad, a clay jar, which was 2,000 years old, It had an asphalt stopper, but an iron rod sticking out of the asphalt. And inside the pot, the iron rod was surrounded by a copper cylinder. And if you put vinegar or some other electrolytic solution in it, it produced 1.1 volts output.
Amazing.
So 2,000-year-old battery. And what they started to find out was there was some evidence of them in Egypt as well, and that and it was called the Baghdad or the Parthian battery, the one that they found initially. And they think that it was used for actually electroplating things with gold in Egypt, which is amazing if you think about it.
Well, yeah, electroplating, you know, it's quite linked to Sheffield as well, that, isn't it? Electroplating nickel, silver and all that.
Yeah, absolutely. So you kind of look and you think, well, the roots of that. But India lays claim that, an Indian sage called Rishi Agastya, 6,000 years ago, created something similar to that battery. So batteries probably got a long history, but then the development really starts, I think. The famous one that you tended to get in school was Luigi Galvani, and he used two different metals to touch on the skinned leg of a frog, and the difference between them made the leg twitch because it created some electricity. That was back in 1791.
Wow. I'm sure you won't be allowed to do that with a frog either now.
It was dead at the time.
Oh, well, that's all right then.
Yeah. that was it, you know. And I think some of that is supposedly the background to the story of Frankenstein.
Oh, yeah, that would make sense.
Animating a corpse. It was that. But he was also a friend of a guy called Alessandro Volta.
Ooh.
And Volta started to look at the voltaic pile and column he created with alternating discs of zinc and silver initially, but also later of copper and pewter. And then he spaced those discs with paper or cloth discs that were soaked in salt water, or again later on sodium hydroxide, and actually put that out as the first electric battery in 1800.
Wow.
So it's famous for that. And Volta,
he
transferred that to volts, gave his name to that measure of electricity. And then, amazingly, 6 weeks after that, in England, William Nicholson and Anthony Coplish used it to decompose water into hydrogen and oxygen.
Wow! So that was pretty fast then.
It's amazing what happens with sort of history. And you then come to one of the things that I remember is a guy called Georges Leclanchier, born in France in 1839, but had to move to England because of the political situation in France with his parents. So he was educated in England when he was young, but then returned to France to the School of Central Arts and Manufactures in France, and became interested in the sort of dry cell battery, which is called the Leclanchier cell. So a cell usually is one generating sort of pair of pieces of metal. But if you then stack those up into a series of batteries, you can create higher voltages and more power. So that's when it becomes a battery. So once it becomes a multiple of a cell, it's a battery. So Leclanchier actually developed the first cell battery using copper carbonate and then zinc into a battery. And his work produced the Leclanchier cell, which was the first sort of forerunner of a dry battery. and he'd moved to Belgium to work on Belgian railways, and it was quickly adopted by the Belgian Telegraph and Railway Administration to power things like the telegraph system. So, sort of quick development of batteries, and you sort of...
I can hear you shuffling your papers, Paul. It's like being on the news.
I should sit at a table rather than have it all propped up on the knee.
You can always blame your cats. He's obviously a bit upset about this business. Rub two cats together, you might get some electricity.
Yeah. Well, he's always been a bright spot. Anyway, so, in 1888... a German called Karl Gassner invented a battery where there's no risk of a solution spilling, because the battery couldn't spill because it contained a liquid. It was in a dry cell or a dry cell battery. Then a Swedish engineer called Jungner invented nickel-cadmium batteries, which are familiar these days, and is sort of a real start. But in amongst that, 1900, Edison invented a nickel iron storage battery, which is what the thing what used to be in cars a lot of the time.
Wow, well, that sounds like, years ago.
Yeah. So, and you sort of look at this sort of continuing development. 1923, Xcel did a dry cell battery for Shell lamps. 1954, National Hyper, the first full metal jacket dry cell battery was released in Japan. Because if you're old enough to remember, batteries used to be very much in cardboard sort of casings.
I have to confess, I don't remember them being in cardboard, Paul.
Yes, they were.
They were quite familiar. And if you had a bicycle in the early days, you used to buy this kind of a flat, oval-shaped, bit like a hip flask shape, with a couple of pieces of brass leaf on the top, and you put that inside your bicycle light, and that was the power source for your bike lamp. So, moved on from that. I think National Batteries did the high top manganese dry cell in 1963, alkaline batteries 64, compact lead acid in 67. High-performance dry batteries production in 69, and it sort of goes through, so lithium introduced, silver oxide batteries, alkaline batteries, zinc air batteries, and sort of so forth through the 100th anniversary of the foundation of Panasonic, which is where that sort of timeline comes from.
Wow.
Was in 2018. So if you think about it, it's over... less than 200 years, but with seeds that go back to 6,000 years, the kind of batteries that we have.
Yeah, and where would we be without them?
Where are we going to be in the future is one of the things that you probably think about.
And, yeah.
They're saying that the future will be solid electrolyte batteries, and battery materials will contain no moisture, so they can... work in extreme temperature changes, and there could also be implanted, like a permanent artificial kidney sort of power source. So that's one of the things. Bio batteries, that's where they can generate electricity from glucose in your blood, which we mentioned before.
Yeah.
So again, for a lot of things like the sort of pacemakers and things, there's a potential there for it to be ongoingly charged from your own body rather than to have it removed and replaced. Seawater batteries.
Yeah,
so they can
generate
electricity from seawater. So if you imagine all the navigation buoys and things, they can have a clean and economical power source. Development of paper batteries, which is in so thin, they're as thin as paper, and can be made into a huge variety of shapes. Temperature batteries, which recharge batteries from the difference in temperature. So if you go from the warmth to the cold, or from cold to warmth. It can be used to generate and top up your batteries.
Amazing.
Ultra microscopic batteries, so tiny that it can be used again across a huge range of things. Plastic batteries, where the case is plastic, so there'd be no restriction on the shape. Again, you can fit batteries into things. But the development of 25-year batteries for emergency sources, so that even after 25 years they can function.
Wow, that would be amazing. It's like light bulbs, isn't it? You know, it's in the manufacturer's interest to make something that's disposable.
Yeah, it's again, you know, batteries is one of those things, isn't it? That Christmas time for kids anywhere, it's a mad scramble.
It's made, well, a lot of batteries are phone batteries. Phone batteries. I know that's another.
Yeah, yeah. Well, again, you know, we've got power banks now as portable batteries to top up your phone, and I think the final one on futures is clothing batteries, which is starting to come more to the fore now. So again, you could charge up your phone from your jacket as you walk along.
I like it. Just going back, before we let you go, Paul, just going back to that,
yeah,
when you talked about full metal jackets, the first battery to have that full metal jacket, is that where the term comes from?
I don't think it is.
No, I just thought it was an unusual, it was an interesting term, full metal jacket.
Yeah, well, it's, as I say, it used to be a cardboard tube.
Yeah, which so it boggles my mind, that, Paul. I think cardboard, electricity, cardboard.
Yeah, well, it was a wrapper around the bits that made the electricity. So it's interesting. And, I mean, we kind of sidestepped one of the issues, which was the laden cell, which was kind of a battery storage device. It was a guy in the Netherlands, I think, sort of refined it. But in respect, if you know anything about electronics, it's kind of a bit more like a capacitor than a battery.
Oh.
So what you find in a lot of electronic equipment now is that original button cell, they can actually create a capacitor which stores a charge, which in effect becomes a battery, but it's kind of recharged as it goes along. So for that kind of backup thing, it can operate in the same kind of way. But the range, the complexity, the development of batteries is just one of the things over the last 200 years, pretty much.
Yeah, amazing.
Come on leaps and bounds. And you know, it's the whole thing about we talk on a large scale now, we're doing wind powered generation of electricity and everything, but we need storage.
And the other thing, before we let you go, Paul, is to mention recycle your batteries. Anywhere that sells batteries, I think, has a duty by law to accept them back and be recycled.
Yes, they do, and we mentioned before that some supermarkets will have a tub where you can put used batteries in.
And you know, there's a lot of them.
Yeah, well, I think you know, the only thing I'd say about it, they don't always make it that apparent.
No, it's true. They're generally hidden away somewhere, aren't they?
Well, a lot of fires in recycling plants, which can be sort of attributed to lithium ion and other batteries, where
people have thrown them in the bin. So yeah,
thrown in the rubbish, and while they're sorting them, they can, like you've seen a lot of things with electric scooters and bikes, where the batteries are put on charge, and people go to bed, and then they wake up to the house on fire because. been a catastrophic failure in the batteries. Yeah.
Exactly. And on that note, Paul, great stuff as always. We shall speak to you Monday, Glory Days Rock Show, 1 till 3.
Good.
Bye bye. Bye.
Cheers. Bye.
Great track there by Suede, Electricity, because RPG was talking all about the history of batteries. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org, talking about science in all its different forms. We should have Chris Dale on the line.
Science.
Good morning, Chris.
Hi, Life Science Show.
Hello. We are fine, thank you. I can't believe it's a month since you did your last slot.
Well, it is, yeah.
Time flies.
I think it's 6 months now since I did my first slot.
Really? Ooh. Yeah, how time passes. So you're going to continue your theme relating to food and health, basically. So you're going to be talking about UK food health and excess weight clinics.
Yeah, well, we've spoken about the impact of Western diet across the world, haven't we?
We have.
We've looked at it specifically. So I thought I'd sort of bring it back to the UK now and maybe talk about the impact that the modern diet is having here.
Yeah.
I thought that might be a nice way of rounding it off.
Yeah.
Actual crack on. So I think the important thing here is that children are increasingly being treated for diseases that used to be seen in older adults.
Yeah.
So there are now referrals for issues such as obesity, diabetes, liver problem in young people, which according to doctors were unheard of a few decades ago.
Yeah.
So the impact has sort of been very significant in like the last 20 years. And there are many reasons for this, but I think the modern diet and lack of exercise are sort of key reasons for this change. And it was interesting that you were talking about the changes in prescriptions.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting, isn't it?
It ties in so well with what I'm talking about. So there are now, across the UK, nationwide, more than 20 excess weight clinics. They're called EWCs, excess weight clinics. And these have been set up to support children with excess weight and the complications as a result of excess weight. And there are more of these clinics being planned. So there's 20 that are up and running, and there's more that are being planned. And this is, you know, very worrying.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
And according to a leading consultant who works at one of these EWCs based in Liverpool, he said the average weight of children attending these clinics is 19 stones or 120 kilograms. Each clinic sort of treats around 200 patients at a time, but there are still waiting lists of over 100 at each EWC, excess weight clinic.
Wow.
Now, you know, if you multiply that across, that's looking at sort of 4,000 patients.
Yeah.
With then another 2,000 patients on the waiting list, and there's still more excess weight clinics coming, and these are directly aimed at children.
Wow.
And consultants are seeing breathing conditions such as diabetes, liver issues, sleep apnea, and this is when at night your breathing stops and starts while sleeping. And children are even needing breathing support at home. And this is all down to, you know, the excess weight. Now, The other thing is that I wanted to mention is that nearly a third of patients are on the autistic spectrum, or they have ADHD or some form of learning difficulty.
That's an interesting point, then. What do you think the connection is there?
Well, because I've been very privileged to work in special schools, and I've seen autistic children who very much like to follow their routine. They like to eat what they eat. And we've spoken before, and I'm going to talk about hyperpalatable foods in a bit again, just to remind people.
Yeah.
But if somebody on the autistic spectrum has got the taste for hyperpalatable foods, particularly things like Coke and sugary drinks and that sort of thing, it's very hard, it's even harder to wean them off it.
Yes.
And I think the reason I put this in is because I want people to understand that this isn't about blame. This isn't about people not caring. This is about the food industry deliberately targeting people and getting them addicted to food.
Yeah, interesting.
So Nearly one in four children now, aged 10 to 11, are classed as living with obesity. And poverty is the root of many children's.
So that's problems. A quarter, then, of that age group.
It is. I'm a little bit sceptical, but these are the facts that have come out from the World Health Organization. So who am I to
challenge? Correct. Those? But it is when you see it black and white, and it's quite stark, isn't it?
It is. And they also say that low incomes can impact on the ability to afford healthy food, and children therefore become addicted to this fatty, sugary food that we know as hyperpalatable food.
Yeah.
And hyperpalatable food have this very specific combination of fat, sugar, sodium, and carbohydrates. So think of something like crisps, we've mentioned that before.
Yes.
That makes them artificially rewarding to eat and harder to stop consuming. Not just in children, but also in adults.
But as a child, that's where you start, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And we had children, and it was very clear how very quickly this sort of hyperpalatable food comes into the diet.
Yeah, well, yeah.
And we had to be, very careful about how we did it. But so I was just going to give the listeners a reminder of what hyperpalatable foods are, or ultra-processed foods. So some of the top offenders are fizzy drinks, packaged sweets, packaged snacks, chocolate, ice cream, biscuits, cakes and pastries, sausages and burgers, packaged pies, pizzas, ready meals and chicken nuggets and that sort of thing. And when you look at that and you think, oh, that all sounds absolutely fantastic. Ultra-processed food that get you addicted.
The interesting thing, you're saying package. If you were making your pie or your pizza at home, the chances are it's not going to be full of all the nasty stuff.
Absolutely. And we did a program on that quite a while ago, didn't we? So talking about how many ingredients go into something that's homemade compared to ingredients.
Yes.
That is shop-bought, because they have so many emulsifiers,
additives,
and all that.
All chemicals. I read an article way back. A researcher or doctor said, if something's got more than five ingredients in it, or anything's on that label that I wouldn't find in my cupboard at home, in kitchen, I would not buy it.
Well, absolutely, 100%. Couldn't agree more. And actually, I'm going to be talking about some of that in a couple of minutes.
Yeah,
but we were talking about the impact on the Western diet in places like India and to the indigenous Red Indians in America. But this ultra-processed food is now so ingrained into UK eating habits, some doctors are having to refer parents to teach them how to cook quick, cheap, healthy foods for their children and to help them get off ultra-processed food.
Which, some of us might think, I did home economics at school, as a lot of people did. That was taken off the curriculum.
No, they still
have
it.
Have they brought it back in?
And we still have kitchens. But it's so ingrained now that people just go and buy stuff from supermarkets without, looking at the labels and seeing what's in them. And before you know it, people are addicted to it because it's there and it's fast and it sort of satisfies.
And sometimes it's a lifestyle choice.
Well,
you talked about Indian in McDonald's in India, and it's become the norm for them to eat out. Because they haven't time and, to do it all. It's an interesting one, isn't it, really?
Yeah. So they also say that type 2 diabetes is almost exclusively due to poor diet, sugar addiction and obesity. And it's now considered to be the UK's fastest growing health emergency. And it's estimated now that child obesity is costing the NHS around £15 billion a year.
Yeah.
Now, the last thing I wanted to say about the World Health Organization report was they believe that by 2030, the UK will become the fattest country in Europe. And by 2040, 4 in 10 of the population will be obese.
So that's in the next 20-odd years, then. They reckon half of us...
15
years. Well, 15 years, half of us will be technically obese.
Yeah. And medical experts now believe the impact of ultra-processed food is so bad, it now needs the most significant health intervention since tobacco was linked with cancer.
And that, for me, Chris, you know, when we were talking about it off air, that's the most shocking thing. And, you know, if you saw that as a headline of a newspaper, which you don't...
Yeah, you absolutely. Know. And I just think more needs to be done. You know, in terms of things like advertising and that sort of thing. And you look at McDonald's, for instance, which I'm sure in very moderation is a perfectly acceptable thing to eat. But they try to sort of link their sort of advertising to things like football and that sort of stuff.
Yes.
And
yeah.
They keep referring to going to McDonald's as a treat.
When actually it's normal.
When actually it's the opposite, really.
And it is expensive as well. You could have a lot better meal if you made it yourself, made your burgers yourself or whatever. But
I don't want to be the all doom and gloom, because there is some good news, is that type 2 diabetes can actually be reversed from if you then have a sensible diet. And I just wanted to clarify what the difference was between type 1 and type 2 diabetes, so it's clear. Type 1 diabetes, the pancreas does not make enough insulin. And this is something that is genetic, so that's something that you're born with. But type 2 diabetes, the pancreas makes less insulin than it used to. And your body can become resistant to insulin.
Uh-huh.
It's caused by your bad diet, your high levels of sugar, and the lack of exercise.
Well, the NHS now is very hot on trying to pick up diabetes, isn't it, very quickly. If you're not me, a blood test, I've just been called up. I'm at that age, and I'm sure one of them is going to be diabetes.
Yeah, and you were referring to that earlier in the show about the prescriptions and that sort of thing, and the treatment that people were having, and it's getting worse, and it's linked to diet.
So. Yeah, definitely.
So you were talking about sort of the headlines, and you know, Sheffield City Council has just recently decided it's going to ban advertising junk food on its billboards. Other councils are following the same. I think Bradford and York are also following, because it's becoming clear that unless we do something and reverse it, it's going to be a national crisis, really.
Well, it is. And it's a modern crisis, because this is, you know, you're saying last 20 years, maybe.
So I think the Life Science Show, we want to conclude by sort of saying we need some major changes to our food and our availability.
Yeah.
And the other day, in preparation for this, I went round a supermarket, a very large supermarket, and tried to find foods without preservatives, emulsifiers, salt, sugar and fat. And it's just everywhere, apart from the fresh vegetables and your fresh meat. All these products, they're in not just sweets, biscuits, sugary drinks, but they're also in things like sauces, you know, your pasta sauces. It's in soups, it's in gravies, it's in cereal, it's in pies, bacon, chorizo, supermarket garlic bread, supermarket pizzas, it's in bread. It's just everywhere.
It is. I think we started this debate then 6 months ago when you talked about let's look what's in a bag of crisps.
Yeah.
And plain crisps generally, but not Walkers, I note, because I check now. Generally, plain crisps are potatoes, salt and oil, and that's it. You look at a bag of flavoured crisps, which you did, I think you looked at cheesy Watsits or something. Or it can just be any flavoured crisp. The list of ingredients is phenomenal.
It is, absolutely. And one of the things that I just wanted to sort of finish on, I mean, obviously, all our sort of pensions and that sort of thing are invested in sort of big companies like Kellogg's and that sort of thing. But when I was in the supermarket and I was trying to find sort of, you know, shredded wheat, that's one that is...
Oh, that's good.
That's fine. That doesn't have any. But I found a product that I've never seen before. which is made by Kellogg's, and it's called Crave. It's K-R-A-V-E.
Which is an interesting title, yes. Even before we start, yeah?
Yeah, and it's a cereal that's targeted at children, just like sort of Frosties and Sugar Puffs used to be. And I was just going to read, well, I was going to try and read some of the ingredients in there.
Good luck, Chris.
Good luck. So it's wheat and oat flour, chocolate flavourings, sugar oil, palm sugar, and palm sugar and palm oil, cocoa whey powder, glucose syrup, and then it's got an emulsifier called soy...
Lecithin.
Soy lecithin.
Yeah.
Citric acid, salt, and then they've got colourings, which is annatto, norbixin, and carotenoids.
Which must be orangey colour, that carotenoids.
Yeah, but, and then yeah. It's got antioxidants, it's got ascorbyl, palmitate.
Oh, ascorbyl palmitate, I think.
Ascorbyl palmitate, and then alpha tocopherol.
I mean, we can't even pronounce what's in them properly, can
sound
we?
Like chemicals.
They sound like chemicals that shouldn't actually be in your body.
Yeah, that's exactly what they are. I mean, surely food like this shouldn't be allowed, you know, and the fact that it's actually targeted at children. Children then get this sort of, you know, they get the taste of sugar, and then it becomes so much harder to then eat fresh vegetables and fresh fruit, because your mouth and your palate just gets so addicted to this sort of thing.
Exactly. If you're used to eating a lot of sugar or a lot of salt, just those two things, once you take salt out of your food, your palate's not used to it, is it?
Mm.
But yeah, like you say, your body's not designed to digest these sort of chemicals.
Absolutely.
And this is, I think, we talked on earlier shows about it. The point of the matter is the obesity is partly due to you overeating, because your body doesn't process these chemicals and doesn't realise it's full.
Yeah, and it craves it. So
yeah, it's more, like cigarettes.
You know, the more you eat, the more you have, the more you want.
Indeed,
and
it is.
It's a very sorry state of affairs.
It is indeed. And so we'll finish on saying, you know, the World Health Organization believe that the impact of ultra-processed food is so bad it now needs the most significant health intervention since tobacco was linked to cancer.
Yeah.
Frightening stuff, Chris, but you've been amazing. Now, are you going to come back and talk to us again in the future?
Well, I hope so, if I'm invited.
You will be.
We've got lots of topics to get through.
We have indeed. So am I right in thinking George Dale's going to be taking your slot next month?
Yes, and he's going to be talking about sports science.
Which is going to be fantastic. You've been amazing, Chris.
Thank
but
you.
You're coming to see us on some of our other shows as well.
Yes, I'm coming on the next... Is it the 27th?
It's the
20th.
It's a bank holiday, May 27th,
really
for this
excited.
Very special glory days. Woohoo!
Very special.
Thanks for talking to us, Chris. I'm putting all the work in.
Thank
amazing.
You.
Have a lovely weekend, all.
You too. Bye-bye, Chris. Bye.
Bye.
Listen to the wind blow, watch the sun rise.
Chain by Fleetwood Mac. Played that because we're talking to Chris Dale about UK food health and excess weight clinics. Big business. This is the end of the Life Science Show this week. We've got the film show in the house, so enjoy. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.